content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 24th, 2023 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week in the background has a large sort of institutional building in the Greek style. It's whitish with the large columns across the front, kind of rectangular. But it's got cracks and crumbles. There's smoke coming out of it. There's gray skies in the background and the initials SVB across the top of the building. Coming out of the front door of it and snaking all the way to the foreground of the drawing is a line of people, hundreds of people, most of them looking on their phone or having their arms crossed. Looks like they're waiting to get into the bank. So the headline is How a Bank Collapsed, The Causes of the Run on SVB, and Why the Feds Rescued Depositors. That is our first main story. We'll start with that. SVB's meltdown prompts federal rescue. What happened? The Federal Reserve launched an investigation this week into the oversight and regulation of Silicon Valley Bank as the Biden administration scrambled to limit the political and market fallout from the nation's second largest bank failure in history. Federal regulators stepped in to rescue all the bank's depositors when SVB, which catered primarily to Silicon Valley venture capitalists and tech startup companies, collapsed last Friday as panicked depositors pulled out $42 billion in a single day. The bank had invested heavily in low-interest long-term treasury bonds that lost value as interest rates climbed, forcing it to sell $21 billion in bonds at a steep loss. A planned stock sale to raise cash sparked fear among depositors, including well-known venture capitalists who aired their worries on Twitter, leading to a run on the bank. Federal regulators announced on Sunday that the government would guarantee all deposits at SVB and at a second failing bank, Signature Bank in New York, not just the $250,000 per depositor covered by federal deposit insurance. This unprecedented step was prompted by concerns the two banks' collapse could trigger a run on other mid-sized banks and create a financial crisis. Wary of taxpayer anger over rescuing wealthy venture capitalists, President Biden and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen took pains to emphasize that bank executives and stockholders would lose their jobs and their money, and that taxpayers were not footing the bill to rescue depositors. Any recovery money not covered by the sale of SVB's assets, they said, would be drawn from an FDIC insurance fund stocked by bank-paid premiums and replenished by a special assessment levied on member banks. This is an important point. No losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Republicans criticized the rescue as a bailout, with many arguing that the root problem was that SVB was a, quote, woke bank, overly focused on diversity and inclusion. I think that really diverted from them focusing on their core mission, said Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. What the editorial said. Biden and his regulators can indulge in semantics all they want, said the Wall Street Journal, but make no mistake, this was a de facto bailout. In a typical bank failure, depositors would get their money back with a 15 to 20% haircut, a hardship for many to be sure, but the $250,000 limit was known. Now that the administration has stepped in to make every depositor whole, they've created moral hazard, rewarding foolish risk-taking and bad management. From now on, rescuing all depositors will be the default policy. Here we go again, said the New York Times. 15 years after the 2008 bailouts sparked populist furor, the federal government is once again stepping in to rescue banks that made risky bets. Americans have every right to be furious, but their anger shouldn't be directed at the bailout itself, which was needed to prevent a larger run on other banks, but at the regulatory failure that got us here. That includes the 2018 legislation signed by then-President Trump, loosening the Dodd-Frank scrutiny for banks of SVB's size. Policymakers must be clear about the steps they will take to avoid a repeat. What the columnist said. Silicon Valley's small government libertarians sure have chutzpah, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. The same tech titans who've long called government regulators a drag on their innovative spirit suddenly clamored for a federal rescue when their millions were on the line. Not incidentally, the bipartisan 2018 bill weakening oversight of mid-sized banks was strongly supported by SVB CEO Greg Becker, who told Congress banks his size present no systemic risks. Biden and his team have set a dangerous precedent, said Philip Klein in National Review. After the 2008 financial collapse popularized the concept of too big to fail, they've now dramatically lowered the bar for federal intervention. It sends the clear signal that investors and financial institutions needn't worry about making risky bets, because if things go south, the government will swoop in to clean up the mess. Stronger regulation is clearly needed, said Sebastian Mallaby in the Washington Post. SVB's failure has shown that the checks and balances of the market will not deter foolish, irresponsible bankers. Federal regulators must put even medium-sized banks through regular stress tests to assess whether they can withstand recessions, big changes in interest rates, or other crises. Republicans can't admit more regulation of banks is needed, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. So they've united around the claim that wokeness is to blame for SVB's failure, citing its pledges to promote diversity, which all the big banks also say they support. There's not a shred of evidence SVB became over-leveraged in federal bonds because it was woke. But this deeply weird argument fills the howling void that exists where a coherent Republican analysis of the issue ought to be. Controversy of the week. Tucker Carlson, the making of a demagogue. It's no surprise to other media people that Tucker Carlson, the Fox News primetime star and host of the highest rated show on cable television, doesn't believe half the things he says on his show, said Jack Schaefer in Politico. But that obvious truth can now be enjoyed more widely. A new trove of documents released last week from Dominion Voting System's $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox includes a slew of texts and emails in which Carlson shares his candid feelings about former President Donald Trump. Quote, I hate him passionately, Carlson wrote, calling his presidency a disaster to which there isn't really an upside. When the cameras rolled, however, Carlson took the same wildly pro-Trump stance that informs his current effort to recast the January 6 attempted coup as a peaceful protest of patriots doing some sightseeing inside the Capitol. Carlson was not always like this, said Alex Shepard in The New Republic. He began his career as an affable, preppy, right-of-center beltway journalist with a vocal distaste for phonies like Bill O'Reilly whom Tucker described in a 2003 book as having a fake shtick as an indignant everyman. But after three of Carlson's TV shows on different networks were canceled and his career was tanking, he realized that hate-mongering is where the money is in conservative media. Liberal media also twists facts to please their audience, said Holman W. Jenkins Jr. in the Wall Street Journal. In the fractured landscape of modern news, relying on evidence and rationally seeking the truth is out of fashion. What gets rewarded today with ratings, clicks, and dollars is telling one's niche audience what it wants to hear, or post-objectivity journalism, as it's approvingly called on the left. That's false equivalence, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. While media bias may be widespread and inevitable, Carlson's sin was in consciously lying on a grand scale to viewers he saw as credulous rubes, while he, other hosts, and Rupert Murdoch were shamelessly rolling their eyes with contempt. It takes deep cynicism to get rich. Carlson's annual salary, $35 million. Famous and powerful by nightly attacking the elites while patronizing the Fox viewers who swooned over Trump as their savior. It would be funny if it were not so sad, said Jonah Goldberg in the Dispatch. Carlson endlessly heaps scorn on the woke snowflakes who demand safe spaces on college campuses, but he and his Fox colleagues have made the network a safe space for gray-haired MAGA fans who can't stand the truth about lost elections or anything that threatens their fragile feelings. Carlson has been caught out of character, said Arwa Madawi in The Guardian, but his viewers won't know or care. Fox has avoided all but passing mentions of the Dominion suit. Besides, being exposed as a flaming hypocrite isn't as damaging as it used to be. In this era of intense partisan tribalism, people just double down when confronted with information contradicting their beliefs or sullying their heroes. But as Trump prepares to run for a second term, said David French in the New York Times, those of us who dread more of his divisive chaos should welcome a new and surprising ally in the upper echelons of the MAGAverse. His name is Tucker Carlson, and he knows Trump was a disaster who lost the 2020 election. Ask him. You just need to ask when the camera is off. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for free speech, with confirmation by a Canadian court that flipping the bird to anyone is not only legal, but a God-given, charter-enshrined right that belongs to every red-blooded Canadian. It was a good week for Russian conscripts, 10,000 of whom have provided personal information to a Ukrainian confidential phone hotline for Russian soldiers who want to surrender discreetly. Callers to I Want to Live line are greeted with the words, Hi, I'm listening, and assured that they will be listed as captured. It was a good week for food fights after Donald Trump's super PAC filed a complaint with the Florida Ethics Commission charging that Governor Ron DeSantis is violating state ethics and election laws by taking and spending millions of dollars for his shadow presidential campaign. But it was a bad week for jumping the gun. After President Biden told the crowd at a fundraiser in California that former President Jimmy Carter, who recently entered hospice care at the age of 98, asked me to do his eulogy, Biden quickly added, I shouldn't say that. It was a bad week for lying low with the arrest of Liu Mufu of China, who robbed a gas station of $24 in 2009 and evaded police for the next 14 years by living alone in a remote cave. Liu, now in his 50s, missed his father's funeral and his son's wedding, which he says he regrets. Finally, it was a bad week for chutzpah after serial liar Representative George Santos filed paperwork to run for re-election in 2024. Santos is currently the subject of multiple ethics and criminal investigations, and 78% of his constituents tell pollsters they want him to resign. Short and other news piece while we're here. Stricter checks for gun buyers. President Biden signed an executive order this week aimed at expanding firearm background checks. Speaking in Monterey Park, California, where 11 people were shot dead at a dance studio in January, Biden implored Congress to do something big. The new order expands the range of gun sellers who must be licensed and conduct background checks. It also asked the Federal Trade Commission to assess how guns are marketed to minors and urges federal agencies to accelerate implementation of last year's bipartisan gun bill, passed after mass shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde, Texas. Biden's executive order was widely seen as a concession that more substantive gun reform will not get through a GOP-controlled House. Our controversy, the briefing, is the truth about alcohol. The emerging medical consensus is likely to come as a downer for drinkers. Is moderate drinking harmless? For decades, doctors advised that consuming a daily alcoholic beverage or two is fine for one's health, or perhaps even beneficial. A growing body of research, however, indicates that toasting to your health is an oxymoron. Studies have found that even modest drinking can have negative consequences, including raising the risk of cancer and heart attacks. Risk starts to go up well below levels where people would think, oh, that person has an alcohol problem, said Dr. Tim Naimi, director of the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. This emerging consensus comes amid a rise in alcohol consumption during the pandemic, as Americans sought an escape from despair and boredom. Cleveland Clinic cardiologist Stanley Hazen said that, in light of new research, he will advise his patients that even the current U.S. guidelines for moderation, two drinks a night for men and one a night for women, might be risky. I'm going to be recommending cutting back on alcohol, Hazen said. How high is the risk of cancer? Alcohol contributes to more than 75,000 new cancer cases per year in the U.S. and nearly 19,000 annual cancer deaths, according to the American Cancer Society. When humans consume alcohol, they metabolize it into acetaldehyde. This toxic chemical can damage DNA, enabling the out-of-control cell growth that creates cancerous tumors. Alcohol is known to be a direct cause of seven types of cancer: oral cavity, pharynx, throat, larynx, voice box, liver, breast, and colorectal. According to the National Cancer Institute, moderate drinkers are 1.8 times more at risk of oral cavity and pharynx cancers, while heavy drinkers are five times more at risk. For liver cancer, increased risk comes from excessive drinking. Studies indicate that for postmenopausal women, just one drink a day raises their risk of breast cancer by up to 9% compared with non-drinkers. What are the other dangers? Alcohol is the third leading cause of preventable death in the U.S., and alcoholic liver disease kills 22,000 Americans every year. Risk of liver disease is greatest among heavy drinkers, but one report found that drinking just two alcoholic beverages a day for 5 years can damage the liver. One drink per day, Hazen said, increases the risk of heart attack and stroke by 10 to 20%. Research suggests that alcohol may accelerate genetic aging and exacerbate dementia. And a study published last year found that drinking just a pint of beer or a glass of wine a day can kill neurons and shrink the brain. Doesn't wine help your heart? For years, researchers believed that moderate amounts of red wine can be healthy, raising the good cholesterol, HDL, and protecting the heart. This was based on the presence of antioxidants found in grapes, such as resveratrol, which is thought to protect blood vessels and slow aging. But a 2016 study found that a person would have to drink at least 500 liters of red wine every day to consume enough resveratrol to get significant benefits. Some specialists maintain that alcohol can improve glucose control, but even low levels of drinking can also increase the risk of high blood pressure, stroke, and an abnormal heart rhythm. Contrary to popular opinion, the World Heart Federation declared last year, alcohol is not good for the heart. Why were the experts so wrong? Alcohol studies are largely observational or based on self-reports. It would be unethical to instruct a random group of study volunteers to drink in excess. That means researchers can't control other variables that might influence health. Older studies that found that moderate drinking is beneficial relied on comparisons of light drinkers with people who don't drink at all. Researchers have since realized that people might abstain from drinking altogether because of underlying ailments. So if light drinkers appear healthier, it's not the alcohol creating the difference. A study published last year based on medical data from nearly 400,000 people in the UK Biobank appeared to confirm this, finding that light drinkers tend to have healthier habits, such as exercising and eating well, compared with people who don't drink at all. How much do Americans drink? About 60% of Americans told Gallup in 2021 that they drink and estimated they had, on average, 3.6 drinks per week. But nearly half of Americans reported binging in the past months, defined as consuming more than four drinks in a sitting for men and more than three for women. In light of new research, some researchers recommend completely abstaining, but most doctors and experts suggest cutting back instead. I'm not going to advocate that people completely stop drinking, said George Koob, director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. We did prohibition. It didn't work. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with Georgia's assault on prosecutors. Could Georgia's state legislature fire a prosecutor for indicting Donald Trump? Asked Norman L. Eisen and Fred Wertheimer. It's possible under dangerous legislation approved by the state's House and Senate in recent weeks. The legislation, which has yet to be signed by Governor Brian Kemp, would create a commission that would have the power to investigate, discipline, and even remove district attorneys if anyone alleges that their prosecution decisions are politically motivated. This vague standard would invite the Republican-controlled legislature to repeatedly interfere with the work of elected district attorneys in Democratic counties and cities. That includes Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis' ongoing investigation into Trump's attempts to reverse Georgia's vote in the 2020 election. With this weapon, Republicans could also intimidate district attorneys into aggressively prosecuting abortion laws and remove them if they refuse. Such interference would be blatantly unconstitutional, both state and federal courts have upheld the separation of powers and ruled that local prosecutors should operate without fear of political retribution. Not surprisingly, Trump's allies enthusiastically support this highly politicized attempt to undermine district attorneys. Kemp or the courts should make sure they never become law. This column comes from Iran, where even loyalists, where even former loyalists are protesting. The ongoing woman, life, freedom protest in Iran may have reached a tipping point, said Maryam Mamarsadeghi. For 7 months, ever since a Kurdish woman arrested for failing to wear a hijab died in the custody of the morality police, the mass protests calling for the fall of the regime have been a grassroots affair. Now, a prominent opposition leader, Mir Hussein Mousavi, has joined the calls for a new constitution. Mousavi, a former prime minister, has always been a poster boy of reform denying reform, the kind of tame opposition leader who wanted to merely soften, not abolish, Iran's theocratic regime. Handpicked by Ayatollah Ali Khamenei to run for president in 2009 election, he refused to lose quietly to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and led the Green Movement against the rigged election. Still, even though he's been under house arrest since 2011, he never called for regime change until now. Iranian late-stage totalitarianism is already showing all the hallmark symptoms of a legitimacy crisis, from corruption and economic malaise to brain drain to spiritual disenchantment among the faithful. Mousavi's defection presents a historic opening for democratic change, especially if other opposition figures follow. Falling with Style. That's the title of our feature article this week. Gary Hunt rules the daredevil sport of cliff diving with a carefree ease that conceals the turmoil of his journey, said journalist Zan Rice in The Guardian. In early May 2009, 12 men arrived in La Rochelle on the west coast of France, carrying a few pairs of Speedos in their luggage. They had not come to swim, but, as they liked to put it, to fly. Their sport, which involves diving from cliffs, buildings, or bridges, always comes with an atmosphere of nervous excitement, but this time the stakes were higher than ever before. Cliff diving had long been at the obscure end of extreme sports, a pursuit for thrill seekers with day jobs. Now the energy drink company Red Bull was launching what it called a cliff diving World Series. In traditional pool diving, the highest event is the 10-meter, 33-foot platform, and even Olympic divers can find the height unsettling. In La Rochelle, the organizers had affixed a short platform to the ramparts of the medieval St. Nicholas Tower, 26 meters above the frigid sea, as high as an eight-story building. In their 3 seconds of flight, the divers would reach speeds of more than 50 miles per hour. As they fell, they would do as many twists and somersaults as they dared in order to impress the judges before hitting the sea. Make a mistake, and it was like you'd run full speed into a wall, as the Colombian Orlando Duque, or the Duke, the favorite to win the new series, explained at the time. A novice from England, Gary Hunt, was 24, skinny and pale. He was still so inexperienced from such heights that he wore two pairs of Speedos for extra protection. Hunt went on to take third place, and as the 2009 season progressed, it became clear that he was a natural. Like all the best divers, he had an acute sense of aerial awareness, always knowing where he was in the air, even as he spun and somersaulted. One of the major challenges of cliff diving as a competitive sport is that it is very difficult to practice in advance from the full height. At the time of Hunt's first season, there were no training facilities with platforms high enough. Today, there are just three, in Austria, the U.S., and China. For that reason, high divers had only ever performed routines that could also be done from a 10-meter platform in the pool. Hunt wanted to try something more ambitious. An unprecedented dive that made the most of the elevation from which he would be falling. He would have to practice his new dive in pieces, and then, on the day of the competition, put it all together for the first time. At the fourth event of the tour in Antalya, Turkey, Hunt felt ready to try. Before the start, when the athletes informed the judges what dives they would perform, Hunt described a routine that had never been attempted before in any sort of diving. A triple somersault with four twists, the triple quad. It would be, as Duque put it, the most difficult dive ever done. Hunt didn't win with his triple quad in Turkey, but he did in the next competition. At the last stop of the season, he introduced another new dive and won again. Overall that season, he finished tied on points with the Duke, who was crowned champion, having won more of the individual competitions. Hunt was content. He hadn't set out to win the series, he told an interviewer during the season, but to explore his potential. Since that inaugural season in 2009, when he finished second, Hunt has been on a run of dominance that would be extraordinary in any sport, winning 42 of 82 Red Bull cliff diving events and 9 of 11 World Series titles. The other two times he was runner-up. He is unquestionably the greatest cliff diver of all time, the Michael Jordan, the Muhammad Ali, the Tiger Woods of the sport, as Stephen LeBou, an American diver who had the misfortune of competing against Hunt for many years, put it in 2021. But Hunt remains strikingly uninterested in the financial opportunities or professional trappings that typically come with such sporting success. He doesn't have a coach, an agent, or any interest in feeding the social media machine. He gives his winner's trophies to his mother, or puts on his carpentry belt and turns them into something useful, like an ashtray or a plant holder's. Trophies disguised as objects, he calls them. Hunt is now 38, but has retained, as L'Equipe newspaper put it, the look of an eternal teen. Like many tales of human flight, this one started with an envious glance upward. Hunt was 9 and in a pool in Leeds in the north of England. As he'd done with ballet and tap and modern dancing, he'd followed his two older sisters into competitive swimming. But Hunt was not a strong swimmer and was bored doing lengths. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw some children jumping off a platform into the water, chatting and laughing as they waited to dive again. That looked more fun. Hunt begged his parents to let him try. He quickly progressed from the 1 meter to the 3 meter and 10 meter platforms, and within a couple of years he was traveling the country for competitions. When Hunt was 16, his parents separated, and his mother moved to Southampton. A few years later, Hunt was joined there by his best friend, Gavin Brown. Though Hunt was a very good diver, Brown was better, winning a bronze medal at the Junior World Championships. Popular and outgoing, he lived by his motto, "Go hard or go hard home." In 2006, Hunt qualified for the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne in the synchronized 10-meter platform event diving with Callum Johnstone. Though Hunt was still only 21, he could see that younger, more talented divers were coming through. If Hunt wanted to be the best at something, there was only one way to go: up. Hunt's first trip into high altitude came later that year when he was still at university. Back then, and to a lesser extent today, the amusement park circuit was a common source of employment for cliff divers. Hunt's diving coach at Southampton had been asked if he knew anyone who could fill in for a private show in Lido di Gesolo, a resort town near Venice, Italy. He recommended Hunt, who readily accepted. Besides performing in sword fights, Hunt's role was to leap into a tiny pool from 18 meters. This was the first time he'd be diving from above 10 meters. The ladder was narrow, and the platform barely had space for his feet. Hunt feared that he might miss the pool, but he quickly got the hang of it and then started trying more complicated dives. Hunt's friend Gavin Brown also tried high diving that summer at a different amusement park. When the pair returned to the house they shared in Southampton, they watched videos of cliff diving competitions and talked about how they might push the boundaries of the sport one day. Brown, more extroverted than Hunt, would sometimes go out partying by himself and then phone his friend to ask for a lift home. In the early hours of April 28, 2007, on a night out, Brown rang Hunt but missed his call. Later this morning, Hunt's phone rang again, and when he answered, he learned that Brown had been knocked over in a hit-and-run accident. He died later that day. In the months that follow, Hunt lost control. "I was just in disbelief that Gavin had died," he told me. "I started to imagine that he was not dead and that I had to accomplish some mission to be reunited with him." A voice in his head told him to walk from Southampton to Bath, 50 miles away. He got lost, and at nightfall he sheltered in a barn where he was found by the police, who'd been alerted by reports of a man on the highway. When Hunt made his debut in 2009, his mental state had improved, though his grief was still raw. Between competitions that first year, Hunt worked as the Walligator amusement park near Metz, in the north of France. His role in the show was playing a high-diving character who believed he was Tarzan. Jane was played by a French actor named Sabine Ravenet, who also ran theater workshops in prisons and for children from troubled homes. She was more than two decades older than Hunt. She spoke little English and he little French, but with miming and patience, they got to know each other. "My first impression was that he was not like the others," Ravenet recalled recently. "In his way of listening to you, of being completely present with you, his gentleness, and also a certain mystery in his personality." They moved in together in Paris in 2010, while continuing to work at Walligator each summer for three more years. Even as Hunt flew to distant locations, from Easter Island to Mexico, on the cliff diving tour. He grew to love the amusement park life. Besides divers, there were clowns, dancers, and puppeteers from across the world. Hunt was also healing. "In September last year, I traveled to Polignano a Mare, a seaside town on Italy's hill, to watch Hunt compete in the penultimate event of the 2022 Cliff Diving World Series. On Friday morning, the day the competition began, I went to meet Hunt for breakfast at his hotel. When I arrived, he was midway through a plate of eggs, bacon, and tomato, which he'd washed down with two coffees, a croissant, and a bowl of granola. 'I don't have to be fussy with what I eat,' he said, laughing. 'I only have 27 seconds of work this weekend.' At Polignano, to reach the diving platform, competitors had to walk from their hotel through the old town, get the nod of approval from a security guard, and enter a cliffside apartment. On the apartment's balcony, two platforms extended out over the sparkling waters. The lower platform, 21 meters above the sea, was for the women who joined the tour in 2014. The men's platform, reached by a ladder, was 6 meters higher. 27 meters is the maximum height for men's competitive diving. Above that, rapid acceleration makes it almost impossible to perform additional somersaults while greatly increasing the injury risk. On the platform, Hunt was casual, not even bothering to bring flip-flops since he planned to take a shortcut back up. He sat down on the edge, swinging his dangling ankles for a while, before standing up and jumping into the void. On surfacing, he waved away the jet ski that takes the divers back to shore and swam to the cliff. After several failed attempts, he managed to leap up with one hand to grab hold of a small ledge and proceeded to scale the cliff like a climber, reaching the platform 5 minutes before the start of the competition. I asked one of the staff if this was normal behavior. "For Gary, it's normal," he replied. Hunt ended up winning at Polignano, and 4 weeks later, he managed to arrive on time at Sydney Harbor for the last event of the Red Bull Series. He needed another victory if he was to be sure of his fourth series win in a row, and his 10th overall, a feat that may never be repeated. It came down to the final dive. Emerging from the water with a huge grin, Hunt hopped over a security barrier and hugged Ravenet. When I texted to congratulate him, he seemed more excited by the prospect of his upcoming week's holiday in Australia than by his latest title. "Woohoo," he wrote, "je suis en vacances." This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The lawmaker who defied sexism in Congress. Pat Schroeder, 1940 to 2023. Pat Schroeder was a warrior for women's rights. When she first entered the House of Representatives in 1972, she was one of just 14 women there, and she knew her presence made the men uncomfortable. "It's really funny if two women stand on the House floor," she said. "There are usually at least two men who go by and say, 'What is this, a coup?'" Over 24 years in Congress, the Colorado Democrat was instrumental in passing historic legislation on violence against women, pregnancy discrimination, and family leave. As the first woman to serve on the Armed Services Committee, she called for arms control, and she did it all while combating sexism with wit. Asked how she could be both a lawmaker and a mother, she replied, "I have a brain and a uterus, and I use both." Born in Portland, Oregon, Schroeder grew up in a household where her father assumed women could do anything, said the Washington Post, and she got her pilot's license at 15. After studying political science at the University of Minnesota, she graduated from Harvard Law School, one of 15 women in a class of over 500. She married a classmate and moved to Denver, where she worked for the National Labor Relations Board and volunteered for Planned Parenthood. When she was 32 and a mother of two, progressives asked her to run just to give feminist views an airing, and she shocked everyone by winning, said the New York Times. She considered a 1988 presidential bid, but decided against it. And when she choked up with emotion while announcing she would not run, it caused a media sensation. Critics said her tears had reinforced stereotypes and set back the cause of women seeking political office. Schroeder handily won a re-election 11 times before retiring in 1997. A year later, she published a memoir titled 24 Years of Housework, and the place is still a mess. It was her parting shot, said Politico, chronicling her frustration with male domination and the slow pace of change in federal institutions. and she didn't apologize for her tearful speech. The critics who seemed most insane to me were those who said they wouldn't want the person who had a finger on the button to be someone who cries, she said. I answered that I wouldn't want that person to be someone who doesn't cry. Here's a technology article, and we'll follow it with the health and science article. Final frontier, preparing for a satellite war. How should the United States respond if a commercial satellite is intentionally shot down in space? Asked Christian Davenport in the Washington Post. White House and Pentagon officials have been trying to determine what the policy should be since a top Russian official said in October that Russia could target the growing fleet of commercial satellites if they are used to help Ukraine. The war in Ukraine ushered in a proliferation of small satellites that have provided real-time imagery of the Ukraine battlefield from space. SpaceX's Starlink satellite network has also kept the internet up and running when Ukraine's infrastructure has been decimated. The Pentagon is investing in more of these systems, and the marketplace for small rockets that can launch inexpensively with little notice could be worth billions over the next several years. However, expanded partnerships with private contractors leads to a host of unanswered questions about what happens if they are attacked. Satellite reconnaissance is one thing, said Sasha Brodsky in the Daily Beast. But one can easily see where space weapons that attack satellites could become an option as competition in orbit heats up. A Denver-based startup called True Anomaly is already operational and uses artificial intelligence to pilot small satellites that will be able to detect and potentially intercept communications from spy satellites from adversaries like China and Russia. Backed by the venture capital firm of U.S. Senator J.D. Vance, Republican from Ohio, True Anomaly is one of many companies vying for defense dollars. Founded by a group of former Air Force and Space Force officers, True Anomaly is the first RPO startup exclusively focused on the military market, said Mark Harris in Wired. RPO stands for Rendezvous and Proximity Operations, an aerospace term referring to the ability to maneuver close to other satellites and train a battery of sensors upon them. Its hunter satellites, named Jackals, will not house guns, warheads, or laser blasters, but True Anomaly's founders recognize the urgency of getting pursuit satellites operational. The deployment of space weapons by America's rivals, said co-founder Evan Rogers, is much closer than most people would think. We are under threat in space, said Sandra Irwin in Space News. Commanders of the U.S. Space Force warned earlier this month that China and Russia have worrisome technologies for targeting valuable U.S. satellites that are not all that well defended. The U.S. needs to focus on deterrence. Right now, the centerpiece of the U.S. strategy is getting as many of the smaller, cheaper, commoditized satellites to get more networks up and activated so that the existing systems aren't sitting ducks. Bees teach each other. Bumblebees can learn to solve puzzles by watching their peers complete them, a new study has found. Researchers at Queen Mary University in London placed a sugar reward in a puzzle box that could be opened by pushing either a red tab to rotate the lid clockwise or a blue tab for counterclockwise. They trained demonstrator bees to open the device, then allowed observer bees to watch their peers do it. When the observers were given the chance to tackle the puzzle, they used the same method they had been shown by the demonstrators 98% of the time, even after discovering that the other button was just as effective. They also opened more boxes than bees in a control group. This suggested that the observers had learned the behavior from their pals, rather than working out the solution themselves. when both blue and red demonstrators were released into the same group. The observers initially learned both methods before settling on one technique, which went on to dominate in their colony. Bumblebees weren't previously known to show culture-like phenomena in the wild, study leader Alice Bridges tells BBC.com. However, in our experiments, we saw the spread and maintenance of behavioral trends in groups of bumblebees similar to what has been seen in primates and birds. And as usual, we'll finish out the show on the talking points page. We will start with an article, Daylight Saving Time. Should it be permanent? In the insanity, said the Los Angeles Times editorial board, every March we turn the clocks forward an hour and then spend the next few days slightly discombobulated. But it doesn't have to be this way. Senator Marco Rubio just reintroduced the Sunshine Protection Act, which would create permanent daylight saving time. And Representative Vern Buchanan, Republican from Florida, introduced companion legislation in the House. Last spring, the bill passed unanimously in the Senate before dying in the House. And yet, it's a popular idea. About two-thirds of Americans say they'd like to eliminate the semi-annual time change, and having extra daylight in the afternoon and evening increases economic activity in downtowns. Few people remember why we started changing our clocks, but it's pure foolishness today. Give us permanent daylight saving time now. Of course, we understand the broad appeal of longer days, said Shelby Harris in USA Today. But with permanent daylight saving time, the sun wouldn't rise in the winter until after 8 a.m. in Maine, 9 a.m. in Detroit, and 9:46 in parts of North Dakota. Tens of millions of Americans would go to work and school in darkness, said Charles A. Sisler and Elizabeth B. Clareman in the Boston Globe, which raises the risk of accidents and health problems. Morning light is the human reset button for our internal circadian clocks, and it lifts our mood and energy levels. Less morning light discombobulates your body clock, and studies show it can lead to loss of sleep, depression, and a greater risk of cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Exposure to morning light is especially important for groggy teenagers, whose natural rhythms tend toward staying up late and waking up late. This debate isn't just hypothetical, said Beth Ann Mallow in Scientific American. We tried permanent daylight savings times before, and Americans rebelled. During the oil crisis in 1973, people thought having light later in the afternoon would save energy. But the expected energy benefits proved largely inaccurate, and people hated starting their days in pitch dark. Changing the clocks twice a year has a real cost, but now that more people are recognizing the downsides of DST, we should consider eliminating it, not standard time. The body of evidence makes a good case for adopting permanent standard time nationwide. And just time for a few of the shorter notes. More than 550 Americans are reported as missing in Mexico, according to Mexican government records, up from 324 in 2020, and almost certainly an undercount. All told, at least 112,150 people have gone missing in Mexico amid an ongoing plague of drug cartel killings and abductions. Vaccinated people currently run a 5 to 10% risk of developing long COVID if they become infected, researchers estimate. For the unvaccinated, the risk of long COVID, defined as symptoms that last at least 3 months after infection, is 15 to 20%, even if they've been previously infected. The head of the Marin County, Florida chapter of Moms for Liberty, Julie Marshall, has succeeded in getting dozens of books banned from school libraries under a law signed by Governor Ron DeSantis. Among them are 20 books by best-selling novelist Jodi Picoult, including The Storyteller, a story about a Holocaust survivor's granddaughter that Marshall flagged for violent flashback scenes. The number of recent high school graduates who went on to enroll in college dropped 8% from 2019 to 2022, the steepest decline on record. During the pandemic, students grew frustrated with remote learning, became more wary of taking on debt, and were tempted by higher paying and signing bonuses in the service industry. And I like two of the quotes today. The first is from Albert Einstein, who says, "Imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world." And hockey great Wayne Gretzky says, "Skate to where the puck is going, not where it has been." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The WEEP is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.